All right, here we go on our education. Part of our education is to study education, okay? So on our first slide here, we have... how do you interpret this? This is distance between the teacher and the student? Is the student stepping on the teacher's feet, or the teacher stepping on the student's feet? Actually, I think both of them actually happen in life, don't they? Sometimes you step on my feet, other times I step on your feet. And I guess that's how education goes, right? We all know that education has been really vital in societies. I mean, that's why you're here. If you didn't think education was important, you wouldn't be in this class, and we wouldn't be getting educated about education, right? I normally show this video about education, but this video, because I upgraded my system, there's no sound. But I can explain it to you. This is how this. Now I don't have a plug-in for the sound. This is how people get to school in this rural area. Seriously, these girls and several other children live up in the hill away from the school. And the way they get to school is they get on this wire and hang on the wire, and this wire goes down about a kilometer from the hill. Little children, you know, as young as like 10 years, and then they'll bring their brother or their sister on it, as you can see here. That's how they actually get to school. And men, of course, do the same thing. The way they've set up this system, because otherwise it takes about 4 or 5 hours to climb down this rugged terrain down to the bottom.
Which country?
I think this is, I can't remember if it's Guatemala or somewhere in South America. So people will take this trip with bags of rice or flour, and when the person at the top swings on down, the person at the bottom swings up, and they pass each other halfway so that the weight of one counterbalances with the other. They have the same weight, basically.
So if there's nobody on the other side, you can't go.
If nobody's on the other side, I don't think that it works. But this is how children get to school. And so the older child will hold on to this with their own braking system. Everybody has their own little braking system. Just a very primitive two pieces of wood that clamp down together. You can see it right here in his hand. And so the younger ones will actually be on the same thing, like a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, with their brother or sister, and climb into the sack. And then that sack will hold their weight. Here's this boy who risks his life, frankly, to go on down and to go to school. Everybody has their own pulley and braking system. I don't know if anybody's ever dropped their brake on the way down. But it's for those of us who have an easier trip to school, it's absolutely looks absolutely terrifying. Because obviously they're going to fall to their death if the... the cord, the wire itself is very strong, but this boy, I believe it has his younger sister inside the sack, and they're going about one kilometer, climb out of the sack and go to school. Why am I sharing it with you? To help you appreciate how you got to class today. You probably didn't have to risk your life to come to class today. Because the Lord has, but this is how important, especially for these who are going to school, to bring their younger sibling to go to school, and this is how valuable getting an education is for them to be able to do that. How valuable is your education? How old is the video itself? Oh, I'm not sure.
Is this current?
Yeah, it's happening now. Yeah, it's probably 5 years old, I guess, something like that.
Recently, there was one documentary in China. The kids got to climb up and down a cliff, vertical cliff.
In China, they're climbing a cliff to get to school?
Yes.
Yeah, even back in India.
Yeah, back in India, what?
Yeah.
They're climbing cliffs?
Yes.
Yeah, I know we're quite spoiled. But you know, it's interesting that we're in education here right now, but I think we really don't talk about education and philosophy of education. It sort of just comes out, doesn't it? I mean, we do, all of us have a philosophy of education. You think getting a master's degree is really important. Are you guys looking at, you're not looking at the website, are you? Don't go look at the website. I'm going to delete it because I saw this is a toxic website. It's somebody gave this to me and I tried to look it up on YouTube, but it's pretty sad looking website. Anyway, don't look it up. It's not properly named. What we're going to address here is how children in Israel and pagan nations were taught. How is it they actually learned what they're supposed to learn? And you'll see that not only was it different in Israel in comparison to other countries, but it'll show the value system of, let's say, pagan societies as it relates to Israel. And in this particular session, we're going to look at it in four different stages. So this is a chronological approach. From Abraham to Moses to the kingdom period to the exiles, going through the Old Testament and seeing how this actually changed. Morton, in his article in Zondervan Pictorial Encyclopedia of the Bible, says, in the ancient world of the Old Testament times, there's no such thing as a secular culture. The Hebrews believed that all truth came from God, who revealed to man the knowledge necessary for his own welfare. So education to Hebrews was therefore about learning what God wanted them to learn. Now, do you feel that way about education? Or do you make a contrast between secular education and sacred education? I suspect you wanted to have to learn godly values and learn God's word, and that's what brought you here to Singapore Bible College. And I suspect most of us can contrast this in our life because I have a university degree in business, and God was at best treated very, very far away and having no inner involvement in our lives. That's a very different idea than what we have really here at the college here. When you think about Abraham and how he set out from Ur, he was actually not only leaving the paganism of Ur, he was leaving the city for country life. Abraham was a city boy who God called to rural life. Abraham was also one who grew up in paganism, and God called him out of the most, frankly, the cradle of civilization. Anybody else who doesn't know God would look at that and say, why in the world would Abraham do that? Why would he leave the cradle of civilization, Sumerian culture, the guys who invented the wheel, the ones who developed all these sciences that we still study today, why would he leave all of that and trade living in houses and wealth for living in tents in a very slow urban lifestyle? What he actually gave up was the kinds of education and schools in Mesopotamia and Sumer, that this is where these children, boys mostly, I think, that were taught how to write cuneiform with their little stylus. And the school setup, typical school setup, was frankly a lot of what we have today. You've got the higher ups all the way down to the teachers and all the way down to the students. And of course, only for boys or the daughters of wealthy people. And these are the areas that they were taught: mathematics, music, languages, public service. Doesn't it sound a lot like what we have studied in our own lives up to this point? Geography, botany, magic. They were trained for religious, commercial, and government work. And they were trained in schools. They were trained away from their home. So similar to what we have today, parents would go and bring their children, especially boys, and drop them off at a public place like a courtyard. And yet God said to Abraham and Jacob and his 12 sons, nothing like this. We don't find the Hebrews following this model that came from Samaria, even though Samaria was known as, you know, it was known as the height about everything, education and culture and all that. In contrast, Hebrew sons were taught the things of God, the covenant, circumcision, the promise of the land. And the Lord said that this father's role, Abraham himself, in Genesis 18:19, he said, "For I've chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him, to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he's promised him." So what was Abraham supposed to teach his children and his household? God said, I've chosen him so that he could teach his children mathematics, botany, geometry, geography. Not at all. And isn't this a pattern for what God really wants us to do in terms of what we can invest? To train those who are younger than us, especially those of us who are parents, to have our children know the Lord, keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. The college asked me today to share my prayer requests relating to my family. That was really actually an easy one. I wrote back and I said, "Pray that my sons would love and know the Lord, really love and know the Lord." I said, "Pray 3 John verse 4 for my sons. I have no greater joy than this, that my children are walking in the truth." I could care less, honestly, what my sons do in terms of their profession. Today is the day my middle son, my 29-year-old, has worked for 11 years. Today's the day he starts flying for United Airlines. He's been working toward this since he was 18 years old. And, I mean, to be a pilot at a legacy airline like United is, frankly, an amazing thing. They have 12,500 pilots. 5 of them are younger than Stephen. So there's 5 younger than him, and then there's him, and then there's the other 12,000 plus. So he's one of the youngest pilots, and it's a huge feat for him. But honestly, I'm proud that he's worked so hard to come to this point in his life. But far greater than that would be for him to do what is right and just, and keeping the way of the Lord is a much, much higher value for me. Because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to follow what God said in terms of education and education of my children, to follow the Hebrew type of education. The Hebrew type of education is that God was all-knowing. So know Him. Study His revelation. This was my own value, and still is my own value. When sometimes people, I've talked to one person once and said, "So do you have a PhD?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, one woman said, "What's your PhD in?" I said, "Bible exposition." And she said, "They give PhDs in Bible?" Kind of very derogatory, like, "What? A silly book like that, they'll grant PhDs?" That was her reflecting the Greek, Roman, pagan. We say Greek and Roman, but this is also Mesopotamian as well. This idea that, man, especially among the Greeks, that man discovers truth, so what you really need to know is to know how to reason. And you're going to find that through science and philosophy. The Greek Empire was conquered, as we all know. You know, the Romans came in and conquered the Greeks, and then the Ottoman Empire came and conquered the Romans. But these Greek ideas are still with us 2 millennia later. They're still with us. That what is most important for us is to use our reason. And the assumption, of course, there is that man in and of himself can find the truth without any divine revelation. Goes all the way back to Abraham, 2000 BC. We're talking about ideas that are 4,000 years old here. Very much ingrained into people's minds. And Moses had the same sort of thing. Acts 7 says he was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. And so we find in ancient Egypt this same idea of schools, a royal court, and this education system, especially designed to train the elite in these matters of magic and medicine, religion, etc. This was very important for them in terms of their smooth functioning of society. So as we note here, subjects taught include arithmetic, geography, poetry, astronomy. And please don't get me wrong, as if these things are bad. You know, these are not bad. I'm just saying they shouldn't be the priority.
So I've been meaning to ask you since creation, what's magic?
What is magic?
Because in creation we're talking about gods created through magic. What makes magic?
Magic is a person, or in the case of the Sumerians, a god, using a force that's greater than them in order to enact some kind of reality.
Yahweh? So how about the Jewish? Isn't that magic?
What would be different for Jewish? In the pagan idea, magic is using some kind of impersonal force that they deem to be greater than the person, whether that person is a human or that person is a god. There's still some kind of force that's higher than them. If you want a modern parallel, this is what we've got in Star Wars. Because Yoda is constantly telling Luke Skywalker that he needs to tap into the Force. This Force is greater than even Yoda. The Force is greater than Darth Vader. The Force is greater than all. And so if you can tap into this Force, it's a very similar idea to what we have in terms of magic. That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because, and I want you guys to feel free to ask any questions as we go along to talk about these, so that I'll just keep going on and on, you know. All right? You're welcome to. When we get to the New Kingdom period in Egypt, we have scribal schools proliferating, and they needed a huge workforce, and so the whole idea is open all this school up more like a public education, not just for the elite. And then they started emphasizing personal piety. And you'll see that in some of the Egyptian literature, where it's similar to the book of Proverbs, where they do talk about things like integrity. Even as...
This last one.
This one, a new emphasis the Egyptians were big on putting human bodies on top of gods. So they put animal heads on human bodies, and that was their depiction of the various gods, because they saw the gods as having human characteristics, but in a heightened form.
What if he wears the helmet, he become god of
it? Yeah, it's not a, well, it probably was a helmet or a mask in some cases like that, but, and so this is what Moses got. Moses certainly knew how to read hieroglyphics, Canaanite script, and Moses, he wrote in Hebrew, so he was quite the learned man. He was a man who had, you might say, a nice balance between his formal education, 40 years in Egypt, his field education, 40 years in the field. And by the time he's 80 years old, he was quite balanced. Right? 40 years of academics, 40 years of FE. I say that so you won't feel bad about 3 years of academics and a few units of field education, you know? His was literally in the field. I mean, it was a field. It was field education in the field. And God prepared Moses in a wonderful way. We see a similar sort of thing with Paul, who had all this academic rigorous training under Gamaliel in Jerusalem to be very conversant in knowing the Hebrew text and all that, as well as Greek. And then also having 3 years out in Arabia on his own after he trusted Christ. In fact, 3 years seems to be a good amount of time to study, when you think about it. Paul had 3 years out in Arabia. When Daniel was taken from Jerusalem and brought to Babylon, 605 BC, you know how many years? You remember how many years in Daniel 1 it says that he studied the Ashpenaz and all that? I just preached on that on Sunday, so it's fresh on my mind. It was 3 years. Daniel got an MDiv degree. He got a Master in Divinities, plural. Because he was studying about Bel, Marduk, all the gods of Babylon, all the literature of Babylon and all that. And so it seems like there's some biblical precedent for you guys to be studying for 3 years for your MDiv degree. By the way, we didn't really study hieroglyphics, and I didn't really tell you about hieroglyphics much when we talked about Egypt, because we watched a video on the Egypt session. But the way that hieroglyphics actually developed is that these pictures, we could tell what these pictures are, right? Obviously, this is a picture of a vessel or a pot. It was believed for centuries that the picture was the word pot. All right? And as scholars were looking at hieroglyphics, they were trying to figure it out for generations, because they saw each one of these pictures. So they're trying to get the whole story here. It wasn't until 1799 when the Rosetta Stone was discovered, and it was a stone that was used actually as a part of the building foundation for a fort, and it had three languages on it. It had Egyptian hieroglyphics, it had Egyptian Demotic language, and then the third one is Greek. And by studying the stone, even though it wasn't complete, it was broken off, the scholars were able to determine and figure out that hieroglyphics was not actually different words for each picture that was actually a sound. So putting three pictures together would, let's say, give you three sounds. And in other words, took a long time to write a word. Because in ancient hieroglyphics, you're writing a picture for every, you're drawing a picture for every sound. So if you have a word of, let's say, four sounds, you know, you're going to be drawing four pictures just for that one word.
Wow.
Well, they experienced back then the same thing we experience nowadays, that when things become laborious, you end up developing the language and you end up using shorter forms. We've seen that happen in Chinese in the last 70 years, 80 years, to go from traditional script down to a short script. We see that happening with language as a whole. If you read English that's 100 years old, unless your experience is very much unlike mine, you will find it quite challenging because the sentences are much longer. It's a lot more difficult. So we tend to move toward being shorter. So hieroglyphic actually ended up being a hieroglyphic book hand, simpler, to hieratic, and finally to demotic. So in the Rosetta Stone, it had both demotic and hieroglyphic. And the Egyptologists were able to finally realize, okay, this very simple strokes here, that is the same as this picture here. And it unlocked the whole study of hieroglyphics. We've learned a lot about Egypt since then. Now, the gender roles were very prominent here because in ancient days, as we well know, the boys were taught the necessary skill of their trades, but they were more favored in terms of being able to go to school. And in many places, girls were just taught domestic skills. The idea was, if they're going to be at home, let's not teach them a whole bunch of stuff that they really don't need to know, you know? But as the Lord designed it, it was the parents' responsibility to teach your children the things of God. Deuteronomy 6 says, "These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up." And so they were to teach their children the laws, the covenant, the customs, including Passover. And this whole thing developed after the tabernacle and the temple came into being, because we end up having an education system developing around the tabernacle, the temple, and I would say the same thing is true today, because we have an education system in the modern day synagogue where people go to the synagogue and they're in classes kind of like this where they're able to be taught these sort of things. When we get to the kingdom period, we have the palace coming about because we've got the king, and there really is no indication of schools for training of palace-related services, but the responsibility for training was in the priesthood. And I think I'd add to that the Levites. The priests and the Levites were essentially the teachers of the land. And we do find a school of the prophets under Elijah, but for the most part, people were still learning at home. And even up to our present day, I can't say I know what happened in your country, but I know in my country, this concept of public education, where everybody goes to a common school and they go to school for several years, very, very new. It was developed by a man named John Dewey, who was the founder, or the Dewey Decimal System is named after him. And we're talking about the 1920s. What I'm saying is the United States did not have public schools where people were sectioned off by grades and all that, except for about the last century. And since the United States is about 245 years old, the great majority of my nation's history was developed by parents teaching their children. That was actually the foundation of the society. It was not sending their children to other places. And you know why John Dewey wanted to invent the public education system? Because he hated God. He was a smart man, and he knew that the way to ruin a society, or he wouldn't say ruin it, he'd say an enlightened society, it wasn't going to happen unless he took the children away from the parents. And so the whole public education system developed by having parents feel inadequate to be able to teach their own sons and daughters what they need to learn, so they would give them up and send them off to other people during the day. And Dewey knew that if you could get children in front of a godless teacher for 40 hours a week, it didn't matter if they went to Sunday school for an hour on Sunday. That 1 hour on Sunday is not going to undo what's done in those, you know, many, many hours of school during the week. I say that because I see just so many, many children who grow up in godly homes, but they don't follow the values of their parents once they're in the school. And it's not getting any better. It's getting worse and worse. And I won't go on and on and tell you many, many stories, but there's quite a few stories. Yes, go ahead.
I was doing the readings, and it said that there were a considerable amount of people who were actually literate. But I think a lot of times when we talk about those times, we say that it was a generally oral culture. So, like, how much did people actually know, like, to read and write?
Okay.
Yeah.
We've been led to believe that when we had homeschooling and all that, that children were less literate.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. It is the opposite. Our literacy has gone down with public education. I mean, take, for example, what many of you have experienced. You were in a school, many of you, with 40, 45 kids in one class. Do you think you can learn better, even with a professional teacher, on a 1 to 45 ratio compared to your mother who's literate, who teaches you how to read? I had a big change in my perspective when my oldest son turned 5 years old, 6 years old. He was in primary one. And we discovered, we were trying not to be too obsessive, you know, in raising him, you know, getting him all stressed out and all that. So I just taught him a little bit. But we discovered when he got into primary one, he was the worst reader in the class. Everybody was reading better than him. And I thought, well, you guys are supposed to teach him how to read, you know? And then I realized, oh boy, I think I need to be the one to actually do this. And so we got a book, and I taught him phonics. I sat down with my oldest, and I devoted 3 months with him. And at the end of that time, just on the one-on-one level with him, he went from the worst reader in the class to the best reader in the class. Within 3 months, 4 months. And right now, I can hardly read his emails because he's got such a vast vocabulary. I need a dictionary to read his emails, you know, when he sends me emails sometimes. You know, he's a lot smarter than me in many ways, you know. But studies show that, I mean, you can look at literature that's written 200 years ago, and you'll see how incredibly complex it is. Now, I know that's not necessarily representing everybody, but even if you just read, as I have, some of the postcards that I have from relatives 100 years ago, just the grammar, the syntax of a postcard, this is just your average person. This is not the, you know, book that won all these awards. It's our abilities actually have gone down. What's my point in all this? Is that we need to be responsible to train people in, especially reading, so they can be self-taught in the Word of God. That was the purpose of going to school even in my country, for as people did for 1 or 2 years. Why did they go to school? Why did they learn to read? It was so that they could read the scriptures and be literate in what God had to say. I find it kind of upsetting to think that in 622 BC, when the book of the law was discovered during the time of Josiah, the people were absolutely shocked to find in the book of the law that they had not done what God said for centuries. We don't really know what the book of the law was. Maybe Josiah found the book of Deuteronomy, or maybe it was a compilation of various laws from the book of, you know, books of Moses. But in any case, they didn't even know the basics, because the people had gotten away from teaching the scripture to their own children. And they obviously had not given priority to copying the scrolls. We do have reliable copies of the scrolls. I'm just saying there weren't enough copies of them, so that even up at the palace, the people weren't really understanding the will of God. When we get to the exile and the folk, the post-exile period, when Israel got away from their land, was in Babylon, we don't really see a scribal class until this time. And if you go to the post-exilic materials, let's say Ezra chapter 7, it really presents Ezra in a very, very positive light because he was a scribe. It gives his genealogy all the way back to Aaron, and it's talking about how important it was for the people to actually get back to the scripture. We see all these people listed in Nehemiah 8 and Ezra, that publicly read the word of God to the people, because they certainly weren't getting it in any kind of public school, classic school that we would call. They were not getting it in their homes either. And so maybe that's why when the synagogue concept was developed while Israel's away in Babylon, the synagogue became the key place of teaching. And even if the parents weren't very literate, they could at least send their children on over to the synagogue each day. And they could, children and adults would be able to learn from the rabbis that had developed during this time. It went from priests actually going on into rabbis by the time we get to Jesus' time. And so observations, conclusions. Jewish education was about teaching the Torah, not academic and technical concerns. It wasn't an education to make a living, but it was about persons and character forming. And they learned their skills through apprenticeship. And the duty of every father was to instruct his children. And the Pharisees, the children were trained in the home by their parents. By the way, you know, people learn through apprenticeship, and most societies today have totally abandoned the idea of apprenticeship. I think we need to have a revival of apprenticeship, especially for men. Because you know what we've done? Not only have we taken children away from their parents, but we have also made schools, in order to be, tried to be as equitable as possible, we have shifted education over to a style that favors women, that favors girls. Are you guys surprised to hear me say this? Girls, now I never had a daughter, okay, but I had a big dose of sons. And girls have the ability to sit for a long time. I'm amazed at you girls, you ladies here. You can sit and color and sew and knit and do these kinds of things where you're just sitting. I think it's incredible the kind of concentration that girls have and women have. And frankly, it's a lot easier to train people like that, who just will sit passively. I notice none of you have been jumping up and running around the classroom during this period. You know, it's a lot of mayhem when people do that. But guys learn by doing things. Guys learn by projects. Do I need to tell you guys? Tell me how you learn. And you know, Jesus, this is getting convicting the longer I talk, but more and more convicting. Jesus didn't set up a school. Jesus did things with the guys. Oh, yeah. Jesus brought the guys around with him. It was hands-on learning. They learned enough. He sent them on out. He brought them back. And yet, today, if you have that kind of a structure, you're not going to get accreditation.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes our goal has become accreditation rather than actually truly training things. I'm glad to see we do field education. But I'll tell you that the students that I've had the greatest relationship with over the years have been students that have been part of my church. And we go and we do stuff together. We're involved in ministry together. And I would love to see that kind of structure followed more in our day. So, so we have, though, eventually we end up with Jewish schools coming. Yes?
Would you see that Joseph?
I do believe that most services are more suited to more church services are suited to females as well.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons why you have men who don't want to go to church.
Yes. The sermons are very male-oriented. Very community.
Perhaps the sermons, it depends on who you're talking about, who's preaching, of course. Perhaps the sermons are male-oriented because they're just relating to mind and not to heart. And that's a good word for us men, to speak to the heart. You might say, learn how to be more of a right brain preacher instead of just a left brain preacher. I've got, you know, work to do on that. And I know we're all going to have strengths and weaknesses in our preaching, but we'll talk about this perhaps if we have a preaching course together. But if you just go and sit, then you're not going to attract men. We've had a whole shift in our men's ministry, honestly. When we started our men's ministry at church, I had it like, hey, this is great. Let's have all the men sit around the table and let's talk about the Bible and our feelings. Do you think it was a success? It dwindled and dwindled and dwindled. The height was nine men, you know. When it got down to about two or three men, I began to realize, I don't think this is the way to train men. So you know what I did? I stepped back from it, and I said, okay, a couple guys, you guys lead the ministry. And one of the guys, a few months ago, he just said, we're going to eat together. That's what we're going to do. And everybody come to my house, and my, he fixed the greatest meal, you know. And then we did the same thing the last time. Just have a great breakfast together. And in the context of that, I brought out a verse, yeah. All right? One verse. Not a exposition, but just a verse on how are you treating your wife? And we talked about that around the table. And I'm just saying I have a lot to learn on these things in terms of how this all works. You know, this picture came out recently I jumped to slide 31. You know, Jesus didn't make his disciples this way, sitting at desks like you all are sitting right now. Why do we sit at desks, and why do we respond that way?
Why you call her?
You know? So we have gone from the tabernacle, the temple, to actually the prophets gave a lot of symbolic messages. They were hands-on. God gave them all kinds of, you know, would you say, visuals. And that's how they taught. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, etc. But we're taught to train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he's old, he'll not depart from it. But how do you do it? How do you train up a child in the way they go? Maybe sitting on the floor and having someone read to you is not the way to do it. Maybe sitting at a desk is not the way to do it. All right, I'm going to let you talk about this with a couple of people near you, and then we'll take a little bit of a break here. I want you to talk about someone next to you about these three questions here on slide 32, and then we'll take a break, okay?